You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where the kids aren't all right. I'm your host, Justin M. Lesneski, and if you enjoy your trip into the midside today, please tell a friend. Referrals are our number one source of tourism. Or alternately, you can leave us a five-star review on iTunes, or hit us up on patreon.com/themidside, or the Matreon. Don't go to that site. I think that site, we might be supporting causes we don't want with that site, themidside.com/patreon, where you can support us per content we put out, obviously our main episodes, and we do some Patreon-exclusive episodes, so might be worth checking that out if you're a big fan of The Midside, if you're a big Midsider. Joining me this trip from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards.
It's a delightful rainy day here in the district. I think it's rained 18 of 22 days, and I'm getting that Lewis Black feeling. He did this bit about living in Seattle where at some point you just want to cut your wrist just to see color. It's kind of how I feel. So I'm in a particularly strange mood.
But you don't have all the annoying Seahawks fans, so it can't be that bad.
Have you met the people who live in D.C.? It's worse.
Oh, that's terrifying. It is. Also joining us from the hills of white privilege, James Elias.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the midside.
All right, James, you're going to have to work on that one, I think. And also, there's more. Wait, there's
what?
More. Joining us, a special guest host from the Center for Industrial Progress, Don Watkins.
Hello.
Welcome, Don.
We're really excited to have you here, Don. Really excited. And to get things started, to sort of introduce you to our audience, I just have to ask, what is the name of your position at the Center for Industrial Progress? And you recently moved to work there, so you switched to there. What made you decide to want to work there and take this position?
Yeah, so, I mean, I used to work at the Ayn Rand Institute, actually with, 66.6% of you. And
yes.
After you guys bailed on me, I lingered around for a few more years. And I had just this really amazing opportunity to work with someone I had worked at the Institute before, Alex Epstein, and who has been a longtime friend and mentor. And my new role, I used to write about a bunch of issues, including the whole inequality debate, which is pretty relevant to this show right here. But I had the opportunity to come help Alex as his director of education, which is helping create content to teach, to offer an alternative environmental philosophy to the green movement. And so that's creating content for primarily the public and the energy industry.
That's awesome. Having worked not in the energy industry, but sort of tangentially in the pro-energy movement, if there is such a movement, I can't tell you how wonderful the work the Center for Industrial Progress does. If any of our audience is unfamiliar, you should Google that term or Google Alex Epstein or Google Don Watkins now. There you go. And check out that work. Knowing people in the industry, it comes up all the time, by the way, Don. The Center for Industrial Progress has made real inroads in a better energy philosophy and getting to the people who work in the industry and arming them. So how do you evaluate
Dan.
The success of the center? Do you think they've done a great good job? Do you think there are wonderful opportunities on the horizon? And how specifically, what do you think the next step is, basically? Where are we? Give us an overview of the environmental philosophy situation.
Wait. First of all, it sounds like Dan is asking if you've made progress.
That was built
into
the name. I
tried so hard to avoid that word that I just stumbled over 19 other words because I didn't want to say progress for a second time.
Lantern hanging.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to say. I'll just say two things. So one is, I think that, as you said, virtually everybody in the fossil fuel industry has heard of Alex Epstein and the Center for Industrial Progress. The number one thing that we need to do now is create a situation where virtually everybody in the industry, or at least hundreds of thousands, have actually been educated in the ideas and are able to deploy them, both to motivate and inspire employees and then to actually persuade the public so that we can have the kind of energy freedom we need to flourish. And so that's really the next level. It's that we have kind of this baseline of knowledge and success, but like we're so far from the goal, which is we are still headed in a really bad trajectory in terms of our policies, and environmentalism is still kind of the go-to philosophy for anything having to do with energy or transformation of nature more broadly. But I would say there's even a wider thing that I'm quite excited about, which is if you think broadly about the whole free market world, I think there's just this real sense that you can't actually persuade people of fundamental ideas and you can't change people's minds about anything important. And I think what you really see with what Alex has done so far is that that is just totally not true. It's really just that we've done a really crummy job up till now. And part of what I think is so amazing about Alex's work is that he's not just persuasive, but he explains how he does what he does. And so I think a lot of people are going to be able to learn from it, not just in energy and environmental issues, but I think in virtually every other issue, there's just a lot that's going to be there to mine. And so hopefully, you know, we're going to see people go not just into other industries, which will be useful, but I think being able to apply it to every sort of issue under the sun.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's really interesting that you say all of that, because sort of what you're saying almost seems like it should be like baseline. I think that's one of the things we talk about on the show here a lot. Like a lot of the things we complain about or we observe, or it's just like it should be baseline, these things you're talking about, these ideas that he's saying and bringing into other industries. And that's a question I have about the name of the whole organization. Is the name intended satirically or not? Because in a way, it seems kind of ridiculous that we even need an organization called the Center for Industrial Progress. It almost sounds dystopic in a way, doesn't it?
I'm curious why you think that, because I see it exactly the other way, which is that it's giving a positive ideal, because you could imagine, you know, the center to oppose environmentalism or something like that, or even the Center for the Defense of Industry, which is much more taking environmentalism as the starting point, and then it's how do we, you know, fight back against them. And this is actually upholding a positive ideal that we should want to see ever increasing transformation of the world to increase humans' ability to flourish. And so I'm very eager to figure out why I'm wrong on this.
You're not wrong at all. You actually said exactly what I was hoping you would say. So thank you. I just think it sounds funny. Like if you think of like a Randian novel, it almost sounds like something that would be in there, almost as if like the opposite side had that. But you've pointed out why it's actually a brilliant name. So thank you for elucidating, right, Daniel? Did I get it right that time?
Elucidating.
Yes, 98 times said on the show this season.
And I actually want to pivot a little bit to talk about the book. You already mentioned that a little bit. You wrote the book Equal is Unfair. And as you pointed out, that's something that is very relevant to our show. And actually, I had a midsider bring up something to me about the book. It was something she was curious about. I'm not going to say her name because I don't know if she wants me to say it on air. But she pointed out that there's not a lot of talk about biology and genetics in the book. And that seems to be something that's a really hot topic right now with the idea of privilege. So do you have any thoughts to share on that about, you know, I mean, I'll just bias the question because fuck it, it's the mid-side and I can just say whatever the fuck I want. The idea that, you know, people are saying it is unfair that people are born with certain advantages or not.
One important point is that the economic inequality debate has been shaped in part by what you can think of as the social justice campaign or the egalitarian movement, but it's actually unique in certain ways in that it has found a wider audience for that. And in fact, like if you read John Rawls, who is the kind of inspiration for this movement in many ways, he's not your typical social justice type of, or, you know, egalitarian you know, tear down sex, race, class, and everything. It's kind of a much more moderate sort of notion that, yeah, we should make things a little bit more equal economically. It appeals to a much larger category than kind of the really nihilistic campus activist sorts, although it appeals to them too. And that's part of why we regard it, my co-author and I, Yaron Brook, regard it as a really important place to kind of draw a line in the sand, because if you think even about people in the libertarian world, you're getting more and more articles about how the free markets are really the solution to economic inequality, which takes it for granted that economic inequality per se is a problem. And so we were treating just one really narrow part of the inequality debate, just the idea that economic inequality is a problem. Because there's also there's a whole set of issues that come up if you're talking about race, class, gender, and all of that. But the specific thing that you raised is sort of part of the argument, and it comes from Rawls, which is this idea that if our outcomes are shaped by things that we can't take credit for, things that are outside our control, then we don't get any credit for our outcomes. So, for instance, it may have been true that Bill Gates worked really hard to create Microsoft, but it's also true that if he hadn't been born so smart, or if he hadn't been born in the 20th century, he wouldn't have created Microsoft. So can you really say that, you know, he gets credit and deserves his income? And I actually have an article coming out at some point on this, but the short answer is that what you deserve credit for is not what you would have done under any and all circumstances. It's not as if, well, if your circumstances would have been different, would you still have achieved X? The question is, given the circumstances you did face, did you make a choice that led to X, or did you make a choice that led to Y? So it's Bill Gates faced a certain set of circumstances, given his nature, given his, you know, who his parents were, given the time he was born in, and he made choices that led to the creation of Microsoft and all of that success, whereas he could have easily said, yeah, I'm going to become an alcoholic, or I'm not going to work that hard, or I'm going to stay in Harvard rather than pursue this, you know, opportunity to start a new business. Like, he could have made all of these other choices given his circumstances. And the fact that he made choices that led to the outcome that revolutionized the way that we live and work, that's what entitles him to take moral credit for what he did. Not the fact that somebody could imagine circumstances under which he wouldn't have achieved it.
Right. So basically what you're saying is you can't argue counterfactuals. And I think it's great. And since you asked to be in the mid-side, I'm going to pivot this into a football metaphor. This is the same argument people use for Peyton Manning. Well, what if Peyton Manning had been with Belichick instead of Brady? Wouldn't he be the greatest quarterback of all time? No, we can only judge them by how they played and the choices they made based upon what actually happened in reality.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I think that's that's actually a rare instance of a perfect football analogy.
Your point, Don, is so, so well taken and so incredibly important. God, I remember freshman year, first seminar of college, reading Rawls and the concept of the veil of ignorance. If we were hidden behind a veil and didn't know who we were, what sex we were, what disabilities we had, what our life choices were, how would we distribute the outcomes? And I remember asking, like, how would we get any outcomes? If we don't know who we are and what we're doing, how do outcomes actually happen? Like, you're taking away the entire choice mechanism. And when I pointed out there was no choice involved, the teacher was like, yeah, that's the entire point. And she didn't understand why I was upset about it. Like, we were just talking past each other at that point. It was incredible. She was like,
when you start freshman year of college and realize you're smarter than your teachers.
Well, that's when I gave up. That's when I stopped caring about 48 hours into college.
I have stopped caring about what's going on right now because you said veil of ignorance. And you know what that makes me think of? All of the things that happened in this past week. So I think we should get to it. What do you think?
Let's do it.
All right. It's time for the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Don, you know, we have guests so rarely, and it's a wonderful thing because I get to sit back and talk less, which is awesome. I hate talking. So I do want to apologize, though, for bringing you on such a lighthearted episode. All we have to talk about this week are mostly dead kids, so I'm sorry that we don't have anything serious to discuss with you and that it's all going to be lighthearted nonsense.
Well, and even when we get to the movie reviews, I mean, come on, guys. I have two kids, so I'm super sensitive to this stuff.
It literally is all dead kids this week. It's quite tragic.
So, holy crap, here we go. This week, of course, an ISIS-inspired or ISIS-driven attacker bombed an Ariana Grande concert, leaving a score of young girls dead. I don't necessarily want to recount the gory details of this. That's not really what we're going to be focusing on this week. What we're going to be focused on is more about how we as individuals and then we culturally should respond to this, or maybe politically respond to this. So one of the bits of news surrounding this week is that a BBC host by the name of Katty Kay, which is, can't be her real name, came under fire because she suggested that Europe is going to have to get used to these kind of things. So she says, Europe is getting used to attacks like this. We have to, because we are never going to be able to totally wipe this out. As ISIS gets squeezed in Syria and Iraq, we're going to see more of these kinds of attacks taking place in Europe, and Europe is starting to get used to that. So, of course, that begs the question, throwing it to Justin first, you know, do we have to get used to it? And two, if we don't have to get used to it, what do we do? I mean, how do we even begin approaching this? And I know we're all foreign policy experts here, so I can't wait to hear.
Yeah, I was just gonna say you asking me to solve world peace on this podcast. Like, it seems like you're setting me up for failure.
Well, if we don't do it, who's going to?
No one. No, I mean, the idea that you should get used to any kind of negative treatment. I mean, there it's just so many metaphors. It's low self-esteem. The idea that you would ever accept, like, oh, I should be treated poorly. Like, how many weeks ago was it where I was talking about the healthcare thing where it's like we're basically in an abusive relationship with government? Now we're in an abusive relationship with terrorism? It's like, ah, oh, that's just the way they treat us. We should get used to them because they have a right too. What if you said that to someone in an abusive relationship? Like, oh, you should just get used to it. That's just the way he is.
They're not going to hit you all the time. They're just going to hit you a little bit of the time, and you should get used to that.
Yeah, you know, when you go with your boyfriend to the Ariana Grande concert and he punches you in the face, like, you should just get used to it. Like, he just doesn't like Ariana Grande, so when you go with him, he has a right to punch you in the face. Like, why is this something that's not okay on a personal level, but it's okay on a societal level like this? It's just so fucking bizarre to me.
James or Don, any thoughts about whether or not Europe has to get used to this style of attack?
Well, I'll say something that occurs to me. So you guys are all fans of Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, as am I. And there's this scene at the end where this dictatorial, quote unquote, you know, head of state, who's really the stand-in for the American president, has kidnapped, I won't say who, but a guy who actually values freedom and is trying to get him to become economic dictator of the United States. And he says, all right, solve our problems for us. The world's falling apart. You fix it. And he goes, all right, fine. Give up your power, decontrol, you know, you guys go away and we'll rebuild the world. And he goes, no, we can't do that. And he goes, then I can't offer you anything to do. And I think this whole idea of, yeah, we have to accept this, it all comes because we've taken off the table the one proven way to stop a deadly ideology, which is that you completely demoralize the people who hold it through overwhelming military force. And that's what we won't do. And so insofar as you take off the table the only solution to something, then yeah, the only alternative is get used to it.
Even London Mayor in 2016, after an attack, said, I think his name is Sadiq Khan, he said that terrorism is just part and parcel of living in a big city. Yeah, it's you know, it's the metro, it's rush hour, and also dying in a bombing.
There's also the metro catching on fire, right, Daniel?
That's right. That's the kind of terrorism that I have to deal with every day.
When I saw this, I actually had a similar thought to you, Don, which was, it wasn't quite as in-depth as what you were thinking there, but it was more along the lines of like, man, I mean, I hate to say this, but given the conceptual context we're in right now, she's kind of right. There is, I guess we're just going to have to get used to it. We won't deal with these people. We won't do what's required to get them to give up. So I guess it's just that anyone who isn't willing to question the way we've been trying to deal with them has to just say, yeah, I guess we just have to accept this level of existence, basically.
And not that I want to.
Based upon,
go ahead, Justin.
What you guys are saying, I agree completely with the conclusion. But isn't the greater problem that this KDK, KKK, whatever her name is,
careful,
rather than saying we need to bomb the shit out of them, or we need to, you know, fuck them in the face, or whatever we need to do to beat the shit out of them, rather than saying that, she just said we should get used to it. Isn't that the greater problem, that we can't just say, let's kick the shit out of these people?
Well, part of the premise that she's holding, and she sort of snuck it in there, and I didn't emphasize it because I was going to do it as a follow-up, but she says...
We're too smart for that.
As ISIS gets squeezed in Syria and Iraq. And part of this is, and this isn't just coming from the left, there's also sort of a libertarian angle here. Sorry, liberty.me folks, we're going to piss you off momentarily, I suspect. Trigger warning.
Well, I think we already pissed them off by saying we should shoot and kill people.
Well, like, that's my point. My point is, the sort of left and the part of the libertarian movement here says that we are basically causing this terrorism by being involved in Syria and Iraq and bombing certain places that we shouldn't be bombing, and that once we stop doing that, then terrorism will end. Then we'll get rid of this. So what is there any legitimacy to that criticism?
No, like, this is one of the biggest things. Like, you see it. I saw it on Arrow this past week too, right? So the culmination of the season of Arrow was the villain has Arrow's son. He has Oliver Queen's son, and then all of Oliver Queen's friends are on an island. And the villain goes, you have to choose to either save your son or save the people on the island. Because if you save your son, I'll blow up the island. But if you save your island, if you save the island and all your friends on it, I'll kill your son. And basically the whole gambit he's doing is he's trying to make Oliver Queen feel like a killer to make him feel guilty. It's him trying to transfer the moral responsibility for him as the villain's actions to Oliver Queen. And it was tough for me to watch the scene because it's like, Oliver, you're not responsible. If you save your son and he blows up the island, that's on him. It's not on you. Just because he says you're going to do something, therefore he's going to do something, it's taking away his free will by saying you're responsible for his actions. And it's the same thing with this whole terrorist argument. Oh, we create more terrorists by going in and making them angry and then they kill people. What... us deciding to do something doesn't mean they have to do something. It's not a deterministic outcome that because we go in there and we assert ourselves that they're going to go and fucking kill innocent people. Nowhere in the rules of reality does it say, get pissed off at America, therefore bomb Ariana Grande concert.
Yeah. Well, I've brought stuff like this up before, Justin. We have this disagreement all the time, but my perspective is that I don't think anyone is, or very few people are that morally stupid, like they like that morally unsophisticated that they think that they literally make that error you're describing. I think there's this.
I saw it in the show. The whole drama of the scene was based upon that moral error.
Right. You know, what was the other one? Was it Civil War that had that going on too? Yeah, Civil War. The Captain America Civil War had that. The whole drama was based on that moral error. But I think the moral error is so frankly retarded to me that I think the only reason it's just so dumb, like, because you think about it for even a moment and you come to the conclusion you just did, Justin. I think the reason people don't think about it that way is because of this kind of, not necessarily blatant nihilism, but sort of like a slant towards nihilism, where it's like, well, if something's good, like America, we should really not give it the benefit of the doubt. We should really take the side of the people who are doing something bad, because we're never really supposed to just say, no, they're just bad. We're not willing to do that. They must be doing it because we're really bad somehow, because really the good is the bad. And no one's thinking of it that way, but there's this feeling that that's the way you ought to approach it, and thus you make the morally retarded judgment.
Yeah, it's interesting. I only bring it up because, well, I bring it up because it's part of the conversation, but because I have a particular coworker at work who I'm close friends with, but this is like his biggest refrain. There's sort of nothing he cares about more, I think, than denouncing America as basically the creator of its own terrorism. And basically saying like this thing will not end until we stop in all foreign intervention. It's very Ron Paul kind of thing. Ron Paul's his big political inspiration. And it's not persuasive to me. It's not persuasive philosophically. It's not persuasive logically. And it's not persuasive historically speaking.
To sort of build on what James is saying from a psychological standpoint, and not to give credence to all these stupid people and dank memes on the internet or anything, but it's sort of the saying that people say that if I have haters, I must be doing something right. And what that basically means from an inverse perspective is, if you are successful, necessarily there will be somebody who hates you. So it's sort of like, well, then if we don't want hate in the world, are we supposed to also get rid of success?
Yeah, interesting. Don, did you have something?
Yeah, I mean, part of what's going on, particularly in the libertarian end of the spectrum, is like there's people who don't believe that others are actually motivated by ideas. So it's like it's got to be that, well, we bombed somebody and that made them sad, so now they're going to come and bomb a whole bunch of teenage girls, as if that actually makes sense. But this issue is actually the best example of how people really are motivated by ideas. Now, those ideas then shape how they take in and interpret certain facts and then respond to them, right? It's not that like a person just reads the Quran and then goes out and blows themselves up. It's that they see the world through this vision that says that in order for the good, i.e., you know, Allah's will to triumph, then, you know, you need to fight the evil, which is that the people who are polluting the world with secularism, namely America and the rest of the Western world. And then they interpret everything through that lens. So, yeah, they're going to complain about bombings and so on. Now, I haven't read this stuff firsthand, but experts that I trust who have actually read the people who have laid down the ideology that's inspiring Islamic totalitarianism, like, it is very clear. And Sam Harris has talked about this at length. Like, if you read it, it really is that they believe in these ideas and they believe in spreading these ideas through violent jihad. And, like, you have to accept that people are moved by ideas. And you can look at the inverse. Why haven't we used overwhelming military force? You can't explain that by, like, oh, we don't have enough firepower. It's clearly and purely because we've restrained ourselves because of our moral beliefs. And so if you believe that we can be restrained through moral beliefs, then you can't doubt that the other side can be motivated by certain moral beliefs to engage in its activities.
Yeah, it's shocking to me. It's getting into this argument with the same coworker about, you know, Islam as an inherently peaceful religion or whatever. And, you know, his point is such that, you know, well, many Muslims don't do these things, therefore Islam is a peaceful religion. It's one of these things that has never been apparent. I mean, it's never been convincing to me, but then marrying someone who grew up in an Islamic culture and hearing firsthand things like, you know, whenever she hears someone say Islam means peace, for instance, she just freaks the fuck out because she's like, it means submission. It means peace via submission, i.e. you lay down your entire life for God and there will be peace. Convert to Islam and there will be peace. But until you do that, there will be no peace.
Yeah, but the way they twist that is they say that it's an individual journey. So it means you yourself submit. It doesn't mean we're going to force you to submit. It's talking about your individual relationship with God.
Yeah.
That's what they say.
And then her response, which I always love, is that Islam, to obtain inner peace, you have to be like the Prophet. The whole point is to be like the Prophet. Well, what did the Prophet Muhammad do? He murdered, created wars, raped, pillaged, etc. What other major religious founder, when you say be like the prophet of this religion, can put war, murder, rape, pillaging on their list of accomplishments?
It kind of makes people saying be like Jesus not seem so crazy anymore. And that's pretty bad when, like, when one group is saying, hey, be like this guy who let himself be executed and tortured on the cross, or be like this guy who just fucking kills people. Like, that's pretty bad when those are our alternatives. Yeah.
Well, I do think it's important, though, to keep in mind a distinction, like, between any given religion and then a kind of ideology that is based on that religion, right? So you can have Muslims who don't believe that it's their job to fight for world domination under a Islamic caliphate. And that's fine. Mm-hmm. I think it's still at like Christianity or any other religion, bad for an individual. And insofar as those ideas shape their thinking or non-thinking, it's bad, you know, as a social influence. But in terms of like what, you don't have to defeat Islam in order to keep us safe. You have to defeat this idea that we should take up arms in the name of creating an Islamic state around the world. And like, that's a much narrower sort of thing. And that's something that you can defeat as an ideology that any significant number of people are going to take action on. Whereas it's not like you have to like convert them all to Mormonism or something.
Yeah. Right. And to skewer the right a little bit, because we've, you know, gone after the left and libertarians a little bit, and only to be fair in this debate, is that's sort of where the hawkishness of the right becomes a problem, because in today's, you know, social media catchphrase news cycle, everyone just says Islam, Islam, and they don't, or they say, you know, in response to that, they say militant Islam. And all that nuance that you just said, Don, is lost. The idea that it's, I don't even want to repeat it because you said it so well, but that's all lost. And it makes all the sides look bad. So when you're sitting here looking for a debate or looking for a side to pick on how to fix this, you're sort of like, they're all fucking idiots. What do I do?
And indeed, not to belabor this point, I'll just say something quickly and move on, which is that, you know, any sort of amount of time looking into it, you can see, and this is plain for anyone who wants to do the research into it, that there are basically two mainstream interpretations of Islam, and one is incredibly peaceful and one is incredibly not peaceful. So part of it is, you know, the interpretation of the religion that we're fighting. So, yeah, but don't talk to my wife about it. She'll say that all Islam needs to go. So, but part of the,
vote FISA 20, whatever.
FISA Richards.
That's right. Part of the question here is like, well, if KDK's response is particularly bad and we don't need to necessarily get used to this, what do we need to do? What is the appropriate response? So there was an op-ed by Brendan O'Neill, who's the editor of Spiked Magazine. It's an online magazine. He wrote an op-ed that went a bit viral, where he basically takes to task the platitudinal messages of love and unity and don't give in to hate and the whole, I would say, Katy Perryology of it's all about just living together in peaceful harmony and blah, 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 blah. So this is what he has to say, and we can respond here.
Did you just say Katy Perryology?
Yeah, she's the one who comes out after all these attacks and is like, we just need to love each other. So she has her own.
I know she did, but the fact that is ever the phrase Katy Perryology has ever been uttered in our lifetime makes me incredibly sad.
That's probably going to be your next album.
Oh. So, quote, it is becoming clear that the top-down promotion of a hollow togetherness in response to terrorism is about cultivating passivity. It is about suppressing strong public feeling. It's about reducing us to a line of mourners whose only job is to weep for our fellow citizens, not ask why they died or rage against their dying. The great fear of both officialdom and the media class in the wake of terror attacks is that the volatile masses will turn wild and hateful. He continues, the post-terror cultivation of passivity speaks to a profound crisis and fear of the active citizen. It diminishes us as citizens to reduce us to hashtaggers and candle holders in the wake of serious, disorienting attacks of violence against our society. And then finally, quote, we need unity, they say. Unity is their buzzword. But this is substanceless, too. Unity around what? Unity against what? What are our values? Who is the enemy of those values? Don't ask, don't think. And then to add perhaps an Ayn Rand phrase, blank out. So, Justin, is he on to something here?
Completely. I mean, I don't want to go too much into the next story already, but this transitions very nicely into the next story, so I'll just set it up. But this is completely the pussification of our society. I mean, stereotypically, right, if you look at the extremes of the two genders, the two, and I said two, you fucking people.
Whoa,
out
careful.
There, of the two genders, which is the one that writes thank you cards and holds candlelit vigils and stands around and mourns? And which is the one that gets mad and punches people in the face when they do shit you don't fucking like?
I'm guessing the first is women.
Yeah, I mean, that's the point I'm making. I mean, my whole life it's been like an escalation of more and more people being more and more shocked at the fact that I get angry about things. And like, you know, I've been made to feel that, you know, if the Patriots lose a game, oh, I shouldn't get angry. If the officials fuck up a game, I shouldn't get angry. That's just the way it is. Now, I understand from the perspective of Bill Belichick that, like, well, it doesn't do him much good to get angry. But I'm sure he still fucking gets angry at some point. But there is a certain thing as righteous anger. And this idea that people don't want us to get angry anymore comes from this idea that they want to destroy masculinity. Hmm. It's one and the same.
Interesting point. James or Don?
Yeah, I mean, in my mind, both men and women, I see what you're saying, Justin, but in my mind, both men and women, this is an attack on sort of the masculine values. But in my mind, both men and women, it's a proper response to not first respond with mourning. You're not allowed to, here's my thought, you're not allowed to mourn, or you shouldn't be mourning until you have acted out your anger. The anger and the hatred is logical in response to such incredible barbarism when you're killing children. And so you owe it to those children for your first response to be anger and doing something about it so it can't happen again. Then you mourn. And both the sexes should engage in that anger and then follow up with the mourning once the problem has been dealt with.
Yeah, I'm not saying women can't get angry.
Of course,
at 300.
But the masculine side of all people has to respond first to defeat the enemy, and then we can engage in the feminine side that we all should engage in, which is the mourning of a loss. But
right, it's
you
the
need
order
both.
Of operations.
Exactly. Math.
Well, there's also another way to think about this too, which I don't think contradicts what you guys said, but you can really just think about this as like the cashing in of Christianity's influence on the West, because like the pagan virtues of strength and so on would have been, there's an uprising, crush it, destroy it. And then instead what Christianity teaches is, you know, meekness, turn the other cheek. In other words, what will often be put as the more feminine virtues. And so I think of the situation we're in is this way. The left says we can't respond because we're the bad guys. And then the kind of Christian right, if you want to put it that way, says, we can't respond because they're the bad guys and therefore we need to sacrifice ourselves to them. And nobody says we need to actually stand up and be self-confident about that we're good and therefore have the right to fight the people who are bad.
Can you imagine if rather than dumping tea in the harbor, and yes, I am going there because I'm from Boston. Yeah. Rather than dressing up like Indians and dumping tea in the harbor, we were just like, you know what? We're gonna get used to these taxes and tariffs and shit. We're just gonna get used to it.
Yeah, if someone did, imagine what would be the equivalent of that? This is getting way off topic, but what would be the equivalent of a Boston Tea Party? I always thought about that. It would be something like throwing the latest load of Chevy Volts into the sea because they've been subsidized by taxpayer money. That's basically the equivalent, because the tea was being subsidized by the English government. They said, no, fuck this tea. We don't care that it's cheap. We don't want it. We don't want these stupid electric cars. Throw them into the sea. And they'd be branded as right-wing extremists. What's that? Sorry.
The San Francisco Bay Tesla Party. That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, to sum up, I just want to give his last paragraph, and then we'll move on to an interesting take on this. But it's such a powerful thing, and I hope everyone feels something from this, which is, quote, stop and think about how strange it is, how perverse it is, that more than 20 of our citizens have been butchered, and we are basically saying, everyone calm down. Love is the answer. Where's the rage? If the massacre of children and their parents on a fun night out doesn't make you feel rage, nothing will. The terrorists defeated you. You are dead already.
Yeah, man. I mean, just to put a button on this, this reminds me of 9/11 so much. I mean, there was a lesser version of this, but we saw this coming down the pipeline then. I remember when 9/11 happened. I'm a freshman in college, right? It's my first semester in college. The towers fall. We find out who did it, and I go, someone's getting fucked up. I go, someone's fucked. There's going to be a hole in the fucking world. And then all of a sudden it was like, oh no, they might be bombing Afghanistan. What's going on? We can't be doing this. Ah, we're going to create more terrorism, and we're still here. It's like we haven't progressed, and we've just gotten worse.
The young George W. Bush Republican in me, still naive, thinking that he might actually do something about the problem. I remember when they were talking about the Shock and Awe campaign, and on the day it started, I actually led a chant of Shock and Awe on a school bus trip. I remember. So
I was in Cancun apparently. With my girlfriend. We were watching TV when the bomb started falling, and I was like, "Oh, where's the shock?" It was pathetic.
Yeah, not enough awe.
That's what she said that night.
Oy vey. Moving on. Apparently,
why don't you have a lot of guests?
Now that we've insulted our guests, moving on.
Because we pussified our society. That's why.
Got to make up for it.
Janie Stevenson, writing in The Independent, says, "It's not Muslims or people with mental health problems who are most likely to kill you in a terrorist attack. It's men." Yes, indeed. She continues, "Mass male violence is everywhere right now. First it was Orlando, then Nice and Bavaria, Munich, Cabal, Fort Myers, an unpronounceable name of a city that I won't try. And each massacre is reported... As each massacre is reported, ministers and media leap to unpick each individual attacker's motivations. Immediately, the snap judgment comes out. If they were brown, they were a terrorist. If not, they were mentally ill. As the attacks mount up, the individual profiling descends into a morbid freefall, and we overlook the most basic commonality. These crimes were all committed by men. In fact, almost all mass murders are committed by men. This is no coincidence." She goes on to blame, guess what? Toxic masculinity, saying that it entitles a man to take a weapon and take other people's lives in the name of his values. Justin, I'm not sure I need to ask you a particular question. All I need to say is go.
I can rant about this from like 80 different angles, but since I already took the angle on the last story about the whole toxic masculinity thing, I mean, you know, I can go in that direction. The thing I actually want to point out is there is a more basic level that she is ignoring here, right? So she's saying the most basic level that everyone has in common is that they're all men, correct?
Right.
Well, isn't it more basic that they're all human beings?
It's true.
So then isn't the solution to end all violence to just end the human race?
I think the environmentalists think so. Certainly violence against the environment. So,
well, it's violence against everything. It's inherently human. So if humans are the problem, let's just end humans. I mean, that's the end point of this logic, is it not?
Oh, your humble proposal is very interesting to me. Indeed.
I think you're just noticing that every wing of leftism has this certain outgroup you have to pick on. And so this is feminism, so its outgroup is men. So you need to attack them when you're a feminist. And then you're making the hilarious point that if you're an environmentalist, the outgroup is the human race. So it somehow ends up attacking everyone, which is really a weird thing to think about.
Yeah,
the outgroup for everything is really the human race. I mean, because what happens if, let's say hypothetically, they stop all men from attacking people because they end toxic masculinity, right? Let's say hypothetically they do that. Well, then if women start attacking people, what are they going to say? Oh, well, that's the masculine part of the woman, so we need to get rid of that too.
Yeah, this is just a misintegration. I mean, I don't know if it's a misintegration. It's probably more purposeful than that, but it's just... I think someone at work said something to the effect, skewering this article, something to the effect of like, it's not engineers who build bridges, it's men. It's like, oh, wait a minute. Right. Picking a correlation and basing your entire ideology off it, probably not a good idea. Gotcha.
Well, maybe we just need to make sure more women get involved with terrorism. I mean, we've got this whole STEM movement right now. Maybe the problem is we're just not pushing women towards being involved in terrorism enough.
I want to point out that this article has gotten 110,000 shares, 1,000 of which occurred in over the last hour I've had the page open, because it was 109.
I wonder if people are sharing it to do what we're doing to it, or hopefully not to support it.
Yeah, my question exactly.
Yeah. Anything to add, Don?
To me, the most revealing paragraph, there's two paragraphs that come at the end, but the one that I'll read, so she says, quote, "We all want to stop these attacks happening, and preventing this devastating violence depends on our ability to prevent male violence in general. we must dismantle societal structures that entitle, enable, and empower men to use violence in all its forms to exert power and control. This is the biggest piece of BS I've ever heard. Like, so, you know, Pearl Harbor is bombed and the Nazis are killing millions of Jews. And it's, well, the way to stop these attacks is we have to stop male violence in general. And until we do that, no, it's these are butchers, and you can actually stop those butchers without solving every possible problem on Earth. What this reveals is that she actually doesn't want to stop the attacks. She's using these attacks as an excuse for promoting the agenda, which if you look at her other articles, I was trying to look at her Twitter account, but it looks like it got taken down or has vanished or something. But it's just an anti-masculinity, anti-man, an anti-capitalist agenda. Like, it's all about, I have a social justice agenda, and this is a good thing to, like, you know, hang my hat on for the day. But there's no real attempt here to understand terrorist attacks or Islamic terrorist attacks or anything like that. It's just, here's a news hook for me to, what is the word? Like, I mean, I guess a kind word is emote. Maybe you guys could come up with one more appropriate to this podcast.
She likes
virtue signal.
So. Yeah.
It's virtue signaling. I mean, it's a great point to bring up, Don, because I think it's the greatest challenge, and this is pivoting a little bit away from terrorism and more towards media, but it's the greatest challenge facing us in this new media age that we're in, is that it's, you know, it's no longer about reporting the news anymore, right? It's about emoting, as you said, it's about virtue signaling. So it's, no matter what happens, you get a avalanche of articles from a bunch of different perspectives, with everyone just trying to twist whatever happened into their perspective. No one's just ever like, what's the reality of the situation? We're going to cover it from a realistic perspective. It's just like, how can we fit this into our agenda? And that's all we get anymore.
Yeah.
Actually, I have a question for you, Don, on this sort of thing. I'm not sure if you remember, but you taught me a little bit how to write in the OAC since you... I think you graded some of my essays in the OAC, and
I'm always afraid that I'm going to walk into a parking lot and an offended OAC student from years past. Well,
you gave me a C on that, you son of a bitch. Yeah. Well, it, you
would
know,
they be able to like lift a pipe to hit you with it. I wouldn't worry about it.
This is something I really noted from this article as someone who tries as someone who really tries to write in a way for people who are new to objectivism to get what I'm saying and try to speak in a way that I don't alienate people with my extreme ideas and my very different ideas than most people. This article is written incredibly badly by my standards, because it doesn't, she talks about power structures and societal structures and toxic masculinity. She uses all these buzzwords that are, you know, probably I'm hoping alien to the general public, and we don't really know what she's talking about. And most articles are like this, yet the feminist, I've seen over the years that the feminist movement has progressed, and it has started gaining traction in the minds of people, not necessarily in full agreement, but people are aware of their ideas and understand what it is they're trying to say. How is it that it's been successful when it's been this garbage writing that doesn't even deign to explain to us what the hell it is they mean? If I wrote like this, no one would freaking listen to me.
Yeah, well, you're not trying to cash in on premises that are already widespread, right? So it's like if somebody wants to feel really good about themselves without any effort, like jumping into a really controversial viewpoint is not necessarily the way to do it, where if you jump into a viewpoint that your professors and your fellow students tell you is noble and good, well, then I mean, that's really easy to do. And look, like most writing isn't written to persuade. Like most writing is made to make the writer have higher status amongst his tribe, and even good writers who are good in certain ways, like if you think about the stuff at National Review by Jonah Goldberg, right? Like he's a good writer, but it's not actually written to persuade. It would not really persuade somebody who holds a different view. And so I think Daniel actually a few episodes back had a really good way of framing it, that it's like what they teach you to do is you inject a bunch of buzzwords or I forget which phrase you use, but like a bunch of things that show that you're part of the correct, you know, tribe, and that is considered writing and communication. But if you actually have views that are challenging the mainstream and you want to grow your movement, then like you have to just do something completely different, which is actually convey effectively a bridge between viewpoints that you're trying to reach and then the viewpoint that you want people to hold. And that's way harder than this kind of garbage.
Yeah. So
it's a great point from a cultural context. And also, just to reinforce that a little bit, one other thing, James, is that each person is not individually trying to get their writing noticed. It's the idea of like standing in a room and screaming until people are forced to listen to you or accept it. And if you just have a bunch of banshees screaming at you all day, you're either just going to shut down and just accept it because you want them to shut up, or it just said so much that you're used to it. So it's also a much different strategy.
Yeah. And by the way, her use of keywords in this it's more blatant than in most articles. She literally has a paragraph here. I won't read the whole paragraph, just one sentence of it, which is toxic, quote, toxic masculinity finds expression in fascism, sexism, white supremacy, Islamophobia, xenophobia, jingoism, capitalism, homophobia, rape culture, and patriarchy.
Hey, notice.
Did I get them all?
Well, you got all the ones she said, but notice what she doesn't include. Yes. For instance, like gangster culture, right? Like rapper culture. What about Islamic culture? Seems to be a little bit of subjugation of women in those cultures. But no, it's only it's only what she associates broadly with, as she caps off that paragraph, you know, the right wing, which is a useless term anyway. Right and left are completely meaningless, and part of why they're meaningless is that they group together things like fascism and capitalism, which are polar opposites.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just one last thing to praise Don about, which is that this whole article reminded me of a, it's not a directly analogous, but it reminded me of a kind of argument that Josh Fox, the maker of Gasland, the anti-fracking documentary, was making. I remember, Don and I, you and I were talking about this, and I was saying that the argument he was making was something like 17% of fracking well casings will leak over time. And Don fucking destroyed the argument in one sentence with no thought whatsoever. Like, it was instantaneous, which shows Don's massive intellect, which is, the sentence was, yes, and 100% of people who contract chicken pox will eventually die. It's like fucking phenomenal. Yes, tremendous. Speaking of death, what a horrible transition. Going out of the terrorism realm here and more into the societal terrorism realm. I don't know. This is from the Chicago Tribune, an incredibly heartbreaking story. School disciplinary incident ends with a Naperville teen suicide. What the hell is this? Well, apparently, Corey Walgren was a 16-year-old, fairly successful 16-year-old, lots of friends, good grades. He was considering going to what college he wanted to go to. Apparently, he was accused of having a videotape of he and his girlfriend having sex on his phone. So the Naperville school, this is Naperville, Illinois, where he lived, sort of shockingly close to where I grew up. The Naperville school where he's at brought him into the office, brought police officers into the office, and basically said that he was possessing child pornography, and threatened that he'd be put on the state sex offender registry. And then he was sort of left alone. Later that day, as he was released, he went to a parking garage and jumped off the building and killed himself, because he was apparently so freaked out about these allegations. The video, by the way, which basically wasn't even a video, was more just an audio that you could barely hear anything. But of course it raises the question, what the hell, dude? / school administrators. Justin, thoughts about this?
I don't understand this rush to put people under 18 on the sex offender list for life for having nude photos or videos of themselves or other people that they are intimate with. I just don't understand it. I mean, talk about demonizing sexuality. So this is a kid who had sex with a girl, and she said he was sending the video to his friends. Okay, if he was, that's incredibly fucked up, right? Yes. I mean, you just, that's an incredible break of privacy. It's just sort of like he'll never be fucking her again if she's rational. Like, the dude fucked up on a major level. Like, there's no denying that. But the idea that somehow this kid who is just learning about his sexuality and learning about himself should be put on the sex offender list for life, there is something really, really wrong with that situation. Especially because I want you to think about this irony for a second. In order to prove he had the video on his phone, the administrator took his phone and tried to watch the video? Isn't that worse?
I never thought about that.
Yes.
That's got to be, like, the worst. Yeah. I mean, and look, I understand that this is a very touchy subject law-wise. Like, what if he actually has a video of a 16-year-old girl and he sends it to someone over 18? Like, what do you do with the law there? Right?
Yes.
Like, is the 18-year-old then in possession? But then what if the 18-year-old gets the video, or the over 18-year-old gets the video, and he doesn't want it, and he deletes the text immediately or deletes the video immediately? Should he still be punished for that? There's just so much that the law needs to be updated with the technology that it's not fair. I mean, I get why he killed himself. I don't think it was right to kill himself, but he did it because he felt like his whole life was ruined. The dude had sex once. Can you imagine? You're 16 and you finally have sex for the first time, and then it ruins your life, and you're like, shit, I can't ever have sex again. Like, I don't know, I might kill myself if someone was like, you can never have sex again.
It's like, it's sort of, you know, it's heartbreaking in so many ways. And yes, this is something that not only is the law going to have to keep up, by the way, as a minor tangent here, but sort of as parents, culturally, we're going to have to keep up with this. Like, figuring out how to interact with our children around the concept of sex and media, as media becomes so much easier, and our cell phone is recording everything, and computers are recording everything.
Yeah, Daniel, don't tell your kids they can put a videotape on their phone, like you said.
A video? Did I say videotape on my phone?
Yes.
I'm a digital strategist. Did you know that?
I know. That's why I was going to let it go, but since you're bringing up the point, I had to bring it up.
No, it's good to excoriate me once in a while. So, yeah, this whole thing is heartbreaking, but, like, for the administrators and the police to sit down and threaten him with possessing child pornography is unconscionable. It's wrong on so many levels. And what's particularly sort of disturbing about this is that the high school and the police basically have said, we did nothing wrong. We followed protocol. So, yeah, it sucks he killed himself, but no blame on us. No blame on us. Ridiculous.
What really confuses me is I don't understand. I've observed the cultural shift especially as a tutor. I've observed this cultural shift, but why did it happen? Because I remember, you know, you'd hear about jokes, like kind of jokes about, like, you know, kids in the 50s like poking a hole and looking into the, you know, women's locker room, and that's gross, and it's, you know, and it's bad, it's immoral, but come on, it's childish. You punish the kid for doing something wrong. You don't – it's not it is categorically different than a crime. So what the fuck? What happened? What changed? I don't even understand why it would change in this way. Do you guys have any guesses?
I would argue that what changed is the technology, and that's why I have sympathy, and I said we need to start learning how to deal with the technology better, because it legitimately – if you're 16 years old and there's a sex tape of you on the internet, that's there forever. I mean, hey, come on. I'm gonna be honest here. We can all be honest here. We can all be adults. Haven't you ever gone on a porn site and, like, put in a search, like, interracial couples, and then it's like an amateur interracial couple on a webcam, and that's the video that's been in perpetuity forever? Like, somehow Daniel and Fiza's video from 10 years ago is still on RedTube or Pornhub or whatever the fucking site.
Oh,
you're
my
at is.
God, Justin.
It'd be interesting to have a sex tape of us from 3 years before we met. That would be an incredible thing.
Yeah.
Actually, I wouldn't even be that mad
making,
about
though.
It. Yeah.
time travel, Daniel, time travel.
I don't think,
but
technology,
you understand the point I'm making, though. That exists in perpetuity. You can't get rid of it. So I get the vigilance, and I get why, like, if I'm a father of a 16-year-old girl and she makes a sex tape with her boyfriend or a guy she's fucking, like, I would be upset about that too. And if him possibly sharing it, that would be one of the worst things, because it could ruin her life. It could ruin his life.
Yeah. It's sort of like,
there's that, but that doesn't seem to cover it for me, because that's not, it's worse. It's worse than poking a hole into the girl's locker room, but it's still the same kind of thing, just on a larger scale. Well, it doesn't feel like it explains it for me. It sounds like there's something else going on. I don't know what it is, though.
I mean, I think it's because you're not demonizing sex as much. Like, I mean, honestly,
sex,
if you
is
found
somehow,
out that,
yeah,
your girlfriend had a sex tape on the internet, would you care?
No, I guess not. Yeah,
okay.
It would suck.
Well, there's the difference between you and 99% of people. I personally would not care either, depending on who she's with or what she's doing. I mean, there's a lot of context there. But, I mean, it's to me, it's not really an essential thing. Like, you know, if somebody I'm with has done drugs in the past or was an addict and or is in AA and now has a coin and is like 10 years sober or whatever the fuck it is, I don't care, because that's part of their journey and who they've been through. But what they've been through. But for a lot of people, this is a major issue. And I think that's the premise you're missing, James.
I don't know. It still doesn't. I know the whole demonization of sex, but that's been there. What changed? Like, that was there just as much, if not worse, in the 1950s than it is now.
Is,
like, what
part of the toxic masculinity thing at all?
Something, maybe, yeah. Or we're just getting way more pussy.
Well, I guess, yeah, the man made her do it, right? Like, she would never, like, what woman would want to do a sex tape? What woman would want to have, you know, a tape of her having sex?
Yeah, it seems to be, it's not just sex, though. I mean, my dad, when he was a kid, burned his clubhouse down with his chemistry set. And he was punished, but the police weren't involved, you know? My dad made a pipe bomb when he was... he made a lot of pipe bombs when he was young and blew them up in his backyard. And he would tell his mom, like, oh, you know, we're blowing up a bomb in the backyard. And she'd say, like, all right, well, you know, don't be late for dinner, you know? And he would have been sent to jail as, like, as a domestic terrorist if he did that stuff today. Like, I don't
only
know.
Because he's white. Otherwise, he would have been invited to the White House for his clock bomb. But I want to be clear for a second. I was being facetious when I was saying what woman would want to do that. I was saying that's their argument, that the men are tricking them and tempting them into that.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I've seen this shift even from when I was a kid to the shift of me tutoring kids and how, you know, a lot of them don't even drive. I don't want to narrow it down to something really, you know, superficial, like, oh, they're just pussies now. But it's a striking change, and I'd love to know more about it.
That's not superficial to say they're just pussies now, because they are just fucking pussies now.
Yeah, but there's more to it than that. I feel like there has to be, because what does that mean? They're pussy. Maybe, yeah, masculinity is becoming diminished in the culture, and so now, like, a pipe bomb isn't something that you just do because you're a guy and you like to see stuff blow up. Like, you do it because there's something wrong with you psychologically.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think the masculinity point is well taken, but Daniel, I want to see what you think about this, or maybe Don, you have some thoughts if you want to jump in here, because you've been quiet for a little.
Don doesn't
but
want to
I
touch
do think
this
that
story
that...
with any football, 10 or 100 or otherwise.
I do think there's something to be said for the technological aspect of it, and what I mean by it is the lack of permanence before. I do think there's a fear of permanence now that has created this, where everything seems much more like a big deal. So when you do something when you're young and you make a mistake, people are like, oh, you're learning, you're making a mistake. But we even see this with pro athletes now, or celebrities, where they make a mistake and they have to come out and apologize for it as if they're morally perfect, or not even morally perfect, have perfect knowledge and never make a mistake. It's like nobody can make mistakes anymore.
Yeah.
It's something where we certainly haven't caught up to the technology. We just don't evolve that fast. Our thinking doesn't evolve that fast. And I think as...
Speak for yourself.
Yes. The ever-evolving man, Justin.
Yeah.
I think it's Adam Carolla, probably. I can't think if he said it specifically, but it has to be because he's the only comedian I listen to. Says that, you know, when our children are running for president, it'll be like, what's wrong with you that you didn't have a sex tape? Like, it's going to be so prevalent that we're not going to care. And I'm not saying that's a good or bad thing. I'm just saying that our thinking hasn't caught up with it yet. It's like, if you're running for president, you will almost certainly have had a sex tape or nude snaps or something leaked on the internet, and that's just going to be, it is what it is, and we'll live with it. But
oh yeah, if I run for office, my dick will be all over the place, so.
That's right. So. Yeah,
nah, he's so far, he's too old, he doesn't need to anymore, like.
He's too busy using it to fuck us. Yeah.
All right, Don, do you have any thoughts you want to share on this?
Nope.
All right, then, Argos, are we ready to move on to more children dying?
Not dying, necessarily.
Jesus, I guess so.
More dead children, yeah. All right, it's time for the Hopeful Romantic with JML. Put me into syndication, broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. I need a rerun to better cast the next series of events. In the air timeline lapse, my made for TV type was written off in the last season when I wasn't focused on. Quickly, I want to start with a review. I'm guessing none of you saw Pirates of the Caribbean 5, Dead Man Tell No Tales.
Wrong.
You saw it?
Yes, I did.
Oh, wow. We can have a discussion now. Okay, so here's the thing, right? So I enjoyed this movie. I want to first and foremost say this. I enjoyed this movie. I enjoyed it more than number 4. I don't know if I enjoyed it more than 2 and 3. I'd have to see 2 and 3 to say. But purely as a fan of the series, I thought the narrative payoff was wonderful. What they did with Orlando Bloom's character and the payoff with all of that, and then the surprise at the end of who was actually in the movie that I didn't expect to be in the movie, that was great. It brought a tear to my eye. I thought it was wonderful. Now, as far as the rest of the movie, I have two observations. One, Daniel, that I think I'm going to be really interested to hear what you think. And then two is just that nobody understands the Pirates movies who are making these movies anymore. So I think I'll start with number two and go to number one so I can throw it to you. So number two is, and I posted this on Facebook, so if you follow me on Facebook or you're friends with me on Facebook, you'll see. No one seems to understand that in the first Pirates movie, The Curse of the Black Pearl, what was so brilliant about it, part of what was so brilliant about it was Jack Sparrow was only pretending to be a buffoon to cover up that everything was calculated that he did. This movie, he's basically just a side character. He's not really driving the plot, and everything he does happens to him by accident. This is like Harry Potter, where the entire fucking thing, everything just happens to Harry. It's the same thing in this movie. I mean, the scene where Jack's going to be executed by guillotine, and then the platform gets shot, so he keeps going around in a circle, and it looks like the guillotine's going to hit him, and then it doesn't, and hit him because of centrifugal force. Like, that's not Jack Sparrow. So he doesn't survive by luck. So there's a basic problem there with the movie. And then, Disney's franchise game. It is clear that they are using the Star Wars model for all of their franchises now. All this movie was an echo of the first, where they have a young guy and a young girl who fill in for Orlando Bloom and Keira Knightley, and they're just doing the story from a different perspective. And likewise, the parallels between this and The Force Awakens, like, you've got a young kid who's trying to find a lost hero from the first trilogy and trying to get him back and go on this secret mission to go to the secret place to find him. And then there's this girl who doesn't know who her parents are, yet she's so special and she's so smart and she's better than all of the men. I mean, I really think they just went to the Pirates people and like, hey, see what we do with The Force Awakens? Do that with your franchise.
J.J. Abrams is a genius. I don't have any different reaction from you. Actually, it's I said to Fiza, because she loves the Pirates, it's not a trilogy anymore, quintilogy or whatever it is, and she was satisfied with the movie, although she didn't think it was outstanding. And I said to her, the Jack Sparrow in this is the Indiana Jones of this movie. He's completely superfluous to the plot.
Yep.
I think everything would happen even if he wasn't in this movie. So
yep,
he's
basically, well, no, because Salazar wouldn't have a reason to try and kill them.
Ah, but there are other pirates. And if he wasn't there, Salazar would have gotten out earlier because the compass wouldn't have been in his possession. So
the whole movie is Will Turner's son trying to free him by getting Poseidon's trident.
What?
And then, yeah, in order to create the drama, to increase the drama, they have an old pirate who's mad at Jack Sparrow trying to kill Jack Sparrow. Who? Why was Jack Sparrow with them to try and get the trident? Why did they need Jack?
See, I don't even know.
I don't remember.
Like, it's just he's a good captain, except that in this movie he's not. So,
oh yeah, they needed a ship and a captain, right?
Yeah, yeah. Ooh, yeah, big deal. So yeah, kind of superfluous, and yeah.
Oh, and Will Turner's son was looking for him his whole life because he would know where Will Turner was because he knew Will Turner.
Yeah, kind of pointless. So it was fine. All I could think of was, yes, this is the last Pirates movie with Johnny Depp, but it doesn't seem that this is going to be the last Pirates movie.
Well, why would they? It's printing money. I told you, Disney's franchise game is on point right now.
Yeah.
I wonder what would Walt think. That's what I would wonder. Like, is this what Walt imagined when he founded Disney?
Well, I mean, he'd probably be impressed with the money-making ability. So, I don't know. I thought this movie was okay, but I didn't think it was anything I'd ever need to see again. So.
Yeah, I mean, you see it, it's over, it's done, move on with your life, right? Yeah. There's so many other better things to watch. I mean, in the trailers... The trailers were like every possible franchise trailer, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I don't know how many you had. We had 35 minutes of trailers.
Yeah, it's getting to the point
Holy
now that
crap.
Like I take two piss breaks inside of the trailers.
I could not believe it. At one point, I was like, I'm kind of falling asleep right now. The movie hasn't started. So,
yeah.
Anyway.
I would like to point out, though, I texted Daniel. What was it about? Was it what was the little girl say? She compared it to Star. There was a trailer she compared to Star Wars. Do you remember what it was?
No.
I could look, but I texted him about that. But the same little girl got excited about one trailer. You want to know what the trailer was?
Yes.
Wonder Woman.
Oh.
So there we go. So to sum up this review, to finish up this review, I give it somewhere between a 6 and a 7, maybe a 6.5. I don't know. I'm sure it's much more generous than you would give it, Daniel.
A high 4, low 5.
Oh man. I give production value so much more than you do.
I went back home and Fiza and I watched Curse of the Black Pearl. It's not even close. Black Pearl's
such
a good movie.
Oh yeah, Curse of the Black Pearl is one of my favorite movies ever. If you've never seen the first Pirates movie, watch that. It's honestly one of my favorite movies ever made. It's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
Trailer takedown. First trailer.
Wonder stars Owen Wilson and Julia Roberts as the parents of a child who is born with physical issues to the point that he needs to have massive surgeries that make his face look really fucked up, and then he starts to go to school. That's the entire plot of this movie.
I feel old. Part of why I feel old is because I feel like I'm getting to that phase of my life where it's like I can pick any premise of any movie and go, didn't I see this in this other movie made 30 years ago? Like, isn't this the premise of the movie Mask starring Cher? No one?
That is actually a movie I have not heard of.
No. Okay. Anyway, it looks touching. The thing about this trailer that I couldn't quite get is if this trailer was targeted at adults or children. Because it kind of had a children's movie vibe. And I thought it might be really good as that. But then it was like, well, some of the things they're dealing with in this are maybe a more adult. I don't know, maybe it's for both. But I couldn't tell if it was like
a children's
a
difference
movie genre or
anymore
not.
Between children and adults?
Yeah.
Is there a difference?
Point taken. I would.
My question.
I might hug this. I'm going to need to see a different trailer. But
really?
Yeah. It's not awful.
Really? Look, from
we're
a narrative perspective,
awful,
since you already opened this box.
Okay.
Really? All right. hold on. I don't remember the other two. Interesting. We're going to get to awful. I think we're going to fight on these next trailers. Narratively, I understand. You need to have a protagonist who's different, right? You need to have a protagonist who isn't the same as everyone else. That's just the basis of narrative. So why, then, does every person have to be different in a bad way? It's part of this whole you know, the meek shall inherit the earth Christian bullshit where it's all we have to raise up the weakest and everything. I don't want to watch a movie. I'm sorry. Like, my heart goes out to someone who had this and had to deal with this, but I don't want to watch a movie about it. I would much rather watch a movie about someone excelling than I would about this. I mean, think about the difference between this and Cars 3. I would much rather watch the plot of Cars 3 than this movie. It's a much better plot. It's a much more compelling plot.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm totally on board with that. I don't like the narrative of like, oh, I'm so weak and I have so many problems, but we can get through it together. I mean, that's fine. That is something you should do. Like, if you feel as though you have these problems and you want to get over them and still, like, you know, have a good life despite your, that's fine. I just don't find the narrative very compelling for my life. I want more out of life than that.
Well, and also, I think there is a place for these stories if it's not every fucking story.
It's not, though.
Yeah, there's a lot of them.
I was going to ask if Don got the trailers. We got Don the trailers so he could watch them.
He did.
Yeah, I mean, so there's a million ways that this movie could be really bad, but I'll tell you, I got chills watching it, and I thought what they did with it was really good is you had this kind of setup of, you know, it's kind of a, you know, a cute kid movie that we've seen a thousand times, and then there's the big reveal that there's something really wrong, you know, with this kid, and I thought that was just really well done. Like, I had that experience of a twist in the space of a movie trailer, and you know, there's some good actors in here, and so I would say that it very likely will not hold up as a movie, but nothing in the trailer convinced me that it doesn't, it couldn't possibly be good.
Yeah.
Is it really a surprise though that Owen Wilson and Julia Roberts' kids would have a fucked up face?
God. Of course you went there. Mask, by the way, is a 1985 American biographical drama directed by Peter Bogdanovich, starring Cher, Sam Elliott, and Eric Stoltz.
And you were 1 year old. What did your mom have you watching as a kid?
And it's about a guy who suffers from craniodiaphyseal dysplasia and who fights with acceptance in society. Means he has a fucked up face.
All right.
Okay.
So hug or tackle, everyone. Dan, I think you already said hug.
I'm hugging.
Hug.
I am tackling.
Tackle.
I can't commit myself to either. Can I be tackle hug fluid for this one?
Pick.
You get tackled for sitting on the fence.
Yeah. I like it. Automatic tackle. If you can't decide if you want to hug it, it's a tackle. All right, tackle. Don.
Tentative hug.
Hug. Second trailer.
The Crossing is another trailer from the new season where last week we did a bunch from the shows teasing their fall season. The Crossing is about a bunch of people coming from 150 years in the future, showing up in the water near some, I guess it must be a beach town or lake town or whatever the fuck it is, coastal town. And they're coming to escape the war in the future. For me, this seemed very much like the 4400 on USA. I don't know if any of you remember that series, but it was about people who had disappeared over the last however many years, 100 years or so, just started suddenly reappearing in a certain year. And it turned out that they were being kidnapped by the future to be given powers and put back into the present to influence the present so that the war in the future never happened. Well, there's a very similar thing here where they show a woman from the future has like these supernatural powers. So
sounds like the same exact show.
It looked like the same exact show to me, 100%.
Wow. All I could think was, if the war happens in the future and you're going back to the past, aren't you just going to end up back at the war? Isn't that how time works?
They went 150 years in the past, though, Daniel. They'll die before the war.
Okay, I guess, but fine. I was just curious if Trump was going to send them back. That's what I was curious during the trailer.
We have to make a time wall.
The future people refugees are taking our jobs.
Yeah,
that's an episode of South Park, right? Where the Goobacks are coming from the future as refugees.
They took our jobs. Yeah. Yeah. So, no. Nothing about this was a yes. Nothing. In fact, when I was watching this, I thought, this looks like a crappier version of Lost. And then not even half a second later, like, from the makers of Lost. Or from the channel
that brought
you
Lost
or something. It was like,
yeah.
Oh, my God.
I don't
think
that's
the worst endorsement I've ever heard from the channel. You could do that with anything, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. Also from the channel brought you 9,800 other canceled shows. Yes.
From the channel that brought you Black-ish. Here's Time Travel-ish. Did you hear they're doing a spinoff of Black-ish called College-ish?
Racist. This is one of the hardest tackles I've ever experienced on this show. There literally nothing about this was interesting. The acting was terrible. The writing looked like complete crap. If some of you like this, I preemptively apologize for my harsh take on this, but you're wrong. So, I just... What the... No! Stop it! That's what I have to say.
Tackle.
Well, before we go to James and Don, I will just offer the counter opinion. I am hugging the shit out of this show because time travel and war.
Hug.
Yes.
And superpowers.
Next week, we should give a review of the show we both started watching that involves time travel that's going to be much better than this. So, anyway, moving forward. That's a teaser.
I was going to hug it for the same reason Justin was going to, but then Lost, the whole thing with Lost just made me think, like, oh, that just makes me feel like this is going to have just the reference to Lost at all. Like, apparently there's no writers or directors or even actors that are in common with Lost in this. They just say, I just saw the words Lost. While I was watching this and just thought, oh, so there's going to be a smoke monster and then they're going to be on the Mars and then I'm not going to know what's going on. And then there's going to be all these questions and then it's going to end. And so I decided, you know what? Life's too short. Tackle.
At the risk of losing friendships, I don't like movies that have time travel, that have magic, that have superpowers. Like, The Wire was too unrealistic for me. No, that's a lie. I love it.
Jesus fucking Christ.
No, it's very rare that I can endure those things. But I actually found this a little intriguing, so I will read the Wikipedia page and find out what's going on. But other than that, tackle.
Hugging the Wikipedia page, though.
To be fair, that's what will happen three episodes in for me. Like, do you remember The Event, the one starring Jason Ritter while ago? Like, that's what happens with all of these, or flash forward. I watched like three episodes and I'm like, all right, this is going nowhere. And then I go to the Wikipedia page to find out it was canceled and no one ever found out what happened.
That short-lived show called V, remember that piece of shit? Yeah, same thing.
Yeah.
From the network who brought you one successful show a decade ago. Speaking of,
I think they should just every show should have that, right? Like the next sci-fi show, it's from the network that brought you Friends.
From the network who brought you Dukes of Hazzard.
From the same artistic media that brought you Casablanca.
From the same executives who greenlit Deal or No Deal.
From the same country that brought you the Transcontinental Railroad.
Oh, I'm trying to think of an example of a really fucked up sibling of someone who was really successful. From the same womb.
Same general marketing strategy that brought you Pet Rock. From the same reality that brought you French fries.
From the same gender that brought you Tom Selleck.
New meme. Let's get on to House Junior, please.
Final trailer.
From the producer that brought you House. Comes The Good Doctor, also co-produced by an actor from the show Lost, Daniel Dae Kim.
In no way related to The Good Wife.
The Good Doctor is about a doctor who's autistic, who nobody trusts because he doesn't know how to deal with people. I also like to call this show Benevolent House, or the crossover between House and Bates Motel, because it does sort of seem like Freddie Highmore is just playing his character of Norman Bates from Bates Motel.
Except he can do tracheotomies.
Yeah, except instead of, well, he can still do tracheotomies in Bates Motel. He just takes your trache out.
That's a tracheotomy.
Nice.
Just being very clear.
Words. So, yeah, I mean, the plot of this is literally the dude's autistic and no one wants him to do surgery because he's autistic, but he can do things better than everyone else because he's autistic.
How do you sustain that premise over any more than three episodes?
Now,
well, they're not going to, Daniel. They're not going to. They're already gearing up for their follow-up, A Cross Between House and Life Goes On.
Oh, my God.
To be fair, David Shore somehow figured out how to milk House for 8 seasons, so.
Yeah, but the trust thing where it's like, oh, now we've seen him do multiple things over a period of time where he's not fucking it up. Like, but yet we still don't trust him because he's autistic.
Yeah, that was a scene in the trailer I didn't really understand. So they have the black nurse who doesn't like him, and then he does the surgery, or he gives them how to find the piece of glass behind the kid's heart, and then she likes him after that. And he goes, so were you pretending before not to care about me, or are you pretending to care about me now? And I wanted to be like, maybe her opinion changed? Is that supposed to be his autism, that he doesn't understand people's opinions can change?
Yeah, I because that was played off as like a deep human insight as well. I was like, evidence?
Right. Because it was like, she just changed.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Also, I like when characters get too emotional enough to pound a table about an autistic kid. That's my favorite in all trailers.
So you're saying they were autistic screeching about an autistic person?
It's just, I forget the guy's name who plays the autistic kid supporter in this show, but he plays Toby Ziegler in The West Wing, which is where I kind of fell in love with him as an actor. But it's like, there's nothing compelling about that in a certain sense, which is, it's just, I'm going to yell about how great he is. Okay, well, you've convinced me now that you've hit the table. Like, I'll just watch him do 3 surgeries and then I'll be convinced as a person of science. Like, I don't know where this goes. Tackle.
James?
House was ridiculous enough for me that they didn't trust him with anything. And so the entire premise was just, is just, no. The main conflict, I just, no. Life's too short, Tackle.
All right, Don, before you go, I just want to say that I am actually going to hug this because it's David Shore and Freddie Highmore, and I just want to give it a chance. So I'm going to hug it.
Hug.
Wrong. I mean, like, so this is just an example of people focusing on superficial similarities. Like, oh, we look at all these quirky genius shows. Like, we have Sherlock and we had House, and it's, yeah, you know what? It's that they basically provided intrigue and comic relief. But if we have somebody like so damaged that they can't actually relate to people, we're not going to relate to them. And if we do, that should be a warning sign. Tackle.
I mean, you're right. Again, it's probably going to be one where I watch for a couple episodes, but I like David Shore. I liked when he did the pilot of Sneaky Pete as well on Amazon. Although I want to make a point here before we transition into talking about Zack Snyder, about Trailer Takedown in general. Even though I'm the one being nice this week and hugging, if you look at the records, I actually tackle at a higher rate than Daniel does.
Insufficient sample size.
That's what she said.
Yeah, from the universe that brought you Carbon.
All right, do we want to talk about another dead kid?
God. Okay, quickly before I cry.
Yeah. So this week, while I was laid up in bed with food poisoning, I had a friend message me, and he's like, "Is it true that Zack Snyder is leaving Justice League?" And I'm just like, "What? This can't be true. Are you fucking with me right now? Like, what is going on right now?" And it's like, yeah, he's stepping down and Joss Whedon's taking over. And I was like, but the movie's already shot. How can Joss Whedon be taking over? So it turns out what happened is in March, Zack Snyder's 20-year-old daughter killed herself, and he decided to try and go back to work on the past couple of for the past couple of months. He screened Justice League for some people and then decided to add some scenes to it, and Joss Whedon was brought in to write those scenes. But since then, Snyder has learned that his family needs him. He needs the time away. So now Joss Whedon is going to write, or not only write these scenes, but direct the extra scenes for Justice League. So there's a number of directions we could go here, but I really want to focus this on the movie itself. And is this a bad sign for the movie?
I don't think it's necessarily a bad sign. I mean, I think, you know, so much of the work is already done on the film. Bringing in Whedon to do the rewrites sort of in conjunction with Snyder being there at least for a little while. And then I think Whedon has said basically that everything will stay the same style and theme and all that stuff. You know, it's a good move for the studio in the sense that it's about as a big a name as you could attach to it to not scare people away. Basically, to tell them that it's going to be okay, that the movie is still going to be a good film. I don't think Whedon will fundamentally change anything. I think he has, you know, some particular ideas that he inflects into things that I don't like. I don't think he's going to be able to do that as much here, but he's a competent director. And in fact, he's a good director if it's just purely taking material that someone else has done. So I'm still optimistic.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing to me here is I actually think this reflects the film better in a way, because what we saw the issue with Batman versus Superman was that Snyder made his cut and they made him cut everything out. Where it seems they were doing the inverse here. This was their compromise. We will let you make a cut, but it'll be shorter. And then if you need to add things in later, you can do that. That seems to have been the plan. Now, the fact that they were letting him do that seems to be a really positive thing for the movie. Good now point. Whedon has come in before and done other rewrites for movies. I mean, famously, one of them he did was Toy Story, right?
Yeah.
So he's done that before. And then the final thing I want to stress is what you already said was there's already the majority of the movie shot here, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, let's say it's like Batman versus Superman, where they've already done a 2.5 hour cut and they're adding another half an hour. You can't just add half an hour throughout the movie and have it be completely different aesthetically and philosophically. It doesn't work that way. You would have to reshoot the other 2.5 hours. So I would expect the same thing to happen here, where we didn't necessarily, just to have it be a cohesive piece, has to have it fit in with the rest of the movie.
Yeah, agreed. I don't think he's a malevolent person. Like, I don't think he's out to destroy movies, Whedon, that is. So I think he's going to take...
No, he just has a very different perspective from Snyder, right? I mean, they're both romanticists, but they have almost opposite point of views.
Yeah. And, well, yeah, I mean, I guess we could... Yeah. Well, that's a debate for a different day. The point is that I think that Whedon is a competent enough writer that he's not going to be disingenuous with the material. So I'm not worried about that. I do feel for Zach, and I wish he was finishing the movie, but I still think it's going to be a decent, if not good, movie.
Yeah, I mean, I feel for Snyder as well, but at the same time, everything we've talked about, you know, regarding him with the Snyder series is what makes him such a great director is how much integrity he has in life, and the fact that he was able to make a decision based upon his values and, you know, step away. I think that speaks to his abilities as a filmmaker, and I wouldn't want him to have handled this any differently, because what enables him to make a good movie is that he's able to do this.
To use a football analogy, Justin. Yes, I'm doing it. Better that Gronkowski stepped away when he did last season, even though he may have been able to play at some point. Make sure that he's perfectly good for the next season than re-injure himself. Basically.
Right. So we can go 19-0 this year.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, and the WB execs did say that his first look deal is still alive with them. So the possibility of the Fountainhead movie.
Oh boy.
Still happening is still there.
Wow.
So that's a really good football analogy about Zack Snyder. Justin, do you have any Zack Snyder analogies about Zack Snyder?
That's asking way too much for me to make. I mean, I'm sure we could compare it to one of his plots or something. But, I mean, you know, there are other concerns about, like, work ethic and things like that. But I don't really want to get into saying that. I don't think it's appropriate to talk about those things. Do you, James or Don, have any comments about the story or what you think it'll affect the movie or anything like that?
I mean, I don't really know comic book movies, and I'd actually never heard of Zack Snyder. But I will say that, like, reading this, I had a lot of admiration for him because it's impossible to project those kind of scenarios, but I could really relate to, you know, trying to jump back into work as a means of coping. But then it's a really hard decision to say, no, this is not working. And somebody who could do that in that kind of scenario, like, that made me want to, like, dive into his work, just that kind of, like, real perspective on his life and on what he finds important.
All right, Midsiders, everybody tweet at Don and tell him to watch Snyder movies and then listen to the Snyder series.
The avalanche is coming.
Of Mark Wickens and Motive Power. All right, James, any final thoughts or you want to move on?
Let's move on.
All right. You know, now that we've had all our serious stuff going on here, I think it's time to get a lot of it out and to cope and to celebrate. I think it's time to have a little fun in Woke or Joke.
Woke or Joke, the game show where the hosts try to guess if the news headline is a real social justice story or if it's satire. Basically, what I'll do is read the headlines, and then Justin, James, and Don will have to say which story is woke and which is joke. Folks, you can play along at home, keep score. Tweet us your results at the Midside and tell us if you can distinguish between woke and joke.
I want to be clear for a second here. Yeah. If you're going to submit a story, please send it directly to Daniel because people keep sending me stories, which then invalidates them for the game.
Fair enough.
I mean, I appreciate that you're trying to help me cheat here, but like, I'm trying to learn from Brady and Belichick and keep my cheating on the DL. Like,
that's right. And props to Midsider Ronnie and to Mark. For sending me stories, and others, maybe if I've forgotten your name, I sincerely apologize. I'm a horrible human being. But thank you for sending me them. It helps a lot. Sometimes there's just so much, and sometimes you send me great stories that we've already sort of discussed in the Midside thread, so we can't include them, but please keep them coming. It's a big help. So are you ready, gentlemen, to play Woke or Joke?
Let's do it.
All right. Round one. First headline. Men did greater things when it was harder to see boobs.
Oh, man.
Story number two. And I'll repeat all the headlines. But story number two. How a DIY asymmetrical haircut helped me eliminate my white privilege. Story number three. Tampons in men's room. It's just a small part of menstrual equity. So to give you those headlines again, headline one, men did greater things when it was harder to see boobs. Story number two, how a DIY asymmetrical haircut helped me eliminate my white privilege. And story number three, tampons in men's rooms. It's just a small part of menstrual equity. Justin, which one is woke and which is joke?
I was hoping I wasn't gonna go first this time because I'm legitimately confused. Like, I forgot the rules of the game now because they all seem like jokes.
They are not. So the point is, one jokes,
one of these is real,
two of these are real, one is a joke.
Oh, one is okay. See, that's why I'm so confused now. Two of these are real and one is a joke.
Correct. So you tell me which one is a joke.
They're all a joke. We have the boobs, we have the asymmetrical haircut and the menstrual. See, here's the thing, like, they can't be so anti-reality that they're saying menstrual equity, can they? Like, they can't, like, that's gotta be a joke. But at the same time, like, the haircut, okay, I'm gonna say the haircut is actually woke, because I can see somebody fucking writing that dumb shit, like, hey, you know, I broke down the need for symmetry and, like, that there are, you know, two genders but that equally reflect each other by my haircut, blah, blah. So that one's real. That's what I'm going to go with. So the question is, are they that retarded with reality that they are going to put tampons in the men's room? Or, you know, are they making fun of men with the boobs thing? Because here's the thing. That seems true. Like, you put boobs in front of me, it's like, I'm not really being productive anymore. It's like, boobs. The South Park did a whole episode about that, right? Bebe gets boobs.
Yes.
But at the same time, have we done less great things now that boobs are more available? Or is it just like Bill Gates only did good things because he wasn't he didn't get boobs until he did the great things? Like, there weren't boobs in front of him. So, I don't know. It's really tough. I'm going to have to say, and I'm probably losing the game because of this, but I got to say the menstruation one is the joke. I have to.
Okay. James, woke or joke?
I gotta say, this is the best trio you've come up with so far, because I have no idea. The first one sounds like some kind of harebrained theory that, like, you know, you ever watch the show Generation Kill, where that guy says, like, I know why Iraq is such a fucked up country. It's because the lack of availability of good pussy. I know why men aren't being productive. It's because you get boobs on demand. That sounds.
Is that a channel, Boobs on Demand? Because I need to subscribe.
Yeah, dude. Yeah, the first one seems just this. I'm going purely off intuition. I have no actual conceptual data to base this on. But I think the asymmetrical haircut is. That feels to me like the joke. That sounds like something someone would write as a joke. The menstrual one is absolutely real. Is what it feels like. That feels completely woke to me.
All right, Don, woke or joke?
I mean, this is the worst. Like, they're all so plausible. But the boob thing has to be true. I mean, it's
part
a fact
of me
it's
thinks
true.
That's the joke.
Right, yeah. I mean, I'm sure there's, you know, if you looked into the statistics, they're probably skewing the data, and, you know, we can have a whole discussion about that.
Boobs!
Yeah, I mean, but tampons in the men's room, of course you have to push for that, because you can't assume that anybody who's going in a men's room is a man. Like, that's off the table.
He's right.
And so, by process of elimination, the haircut has to be the joke.
Are none of us right? Are none of us right?
No, I'm sorry, Justin, but in fact, the joke article is how a DIY asymmetrical haircut helps me eliminate my white privilege.
I gotta watch that one. Or read that one.
All right. We'll
The giveaway was the idea that you could actually get rid of your white privilege. Like that.
Oh. Zing. It was right there in front of me the whole time.
This week.
And I didn't see it.
And we'll put up all these stories at themidside.com/podcast. So round two of woke or joke. Vatican celebrates Big Bang to dispel faith science conflict. Our headline number two. Republican healthcare plan lacks coverage for injuries resulting from body slamming. Headline number three. U.S. flower sellers rush to destroy illegal genetically modified petunias. Headline number one. To read these again. Vatican celebrates Big Bang to dispel faith science conflict. Headline number two, Republican health plan lacks coverage for injuries resulting from body slamming. And headline number three, U.S. flower sellers rush to destroy illegal genetically modified petunias. James, woke or joke?
Oh my God. The third one is definitely woke, because that happened. is all I can say. The first two, though, oh my god! Like I'm forced to pick between those two as being jokes. They both. Oh, okay. The first one's the joke, because here's why. The second one is just woke because they're trying to. It's kind of like the article they were writing about how the Republican plan doesn't cover rape. They're just doing the same thing there, I think. So the joke is the Vatican Big Bang celebration, because the Vatican wouldn't have us, you know, celebrate the Big Bang. That's not a thing they do.
All right. Don, woke or joke?
Yeah, I mean, the GMO thing has to be true. I mean, all they do is trample anything that could possibly improve human well-being, so petunias are helpful, at least what visually, they gotta go. The Vatican one, I totally believe. Christians have like come around and realized that they can use the Big Bang to their favor, because they can say, look, it's scientifically proven the universe is an eternal, so if it had to have a beginning, where'd the beginning come from? So I'm tempted to say that is woke, which leaves us with, what is it? The
Republican healthcare plan lacks coverage for injuries resulting from body slamming.
That sounds like a lame attempt at an Onion style headline. So I'm going to go joke for that.
All right. Justin, woke or joke?
I also think number two is the joke for similar reasons to Don. I think they're trying to merge the idea of social justice and professional wrestling, because you would never see social justice in professional wrestling. But just the idea of like Triple H or Hulk Hogan or Bobby Roode being out there and being like, oh no, that's not fair. It doesn't cover body slamming. Like, how ridiculous is that? So I think that's the joke they're going for there.
All right. And the joke headline this round, gentlemen, was Republican healthcare plan lacks coverage for injuries resulting from body slamming. Couldn't help but snicker to myself when Don said it was a poor attempt at an Onion-style headline, because it is from the Borowitz Report, which is basically a poor attempt at satire. So,
is it a professional wrestling joke?
No, it has to do with Michael Gianforte, who body slammed the reporter.
Oh.
Recently.
See, we did it better than they did it.
Yeah. So, after two rounds, Don way out ahead with two, and James and Justin tied at one.
How is he way out ahead?
There are only three rounds.
I doubled your score.
That's right. There are only three rounds.
It's not like he's up 28-3 or something.
This is like a think soccer, not basketball, Justin.
That's right. He won by a landslide if he wins by one.
Yeah.
All right, gentlemen, round three of Woke or Joke. Headline one. The epitome of privilege, this school has its own police officers. Headline number two. Yale Dean loves diversity except for white trash. Headline number three. Student group apologizes for playing, quote, problematic Lou Reed song. To read those headlines again. Headline one, the epitome of privilege, this school has its own police officers. Headline number two, Yale Dean loves diversity except for white trash. And headline number three, student group apologizes for playing, quote, problematic Lou Reed song. Don, woke or joke?
Wow, this one I have no clue. So the Lou Reed one sounds pretty plausible. I mean, you could just plug in any musician and it would totally make sense.
Yale Dean loves diversity except for white trash.
I mean, that sounds like a headline that like Milo would write.
Yeah.
So I'm tempted to believe it. Whereas if you took it straight, like it doesn't. That wasn't a slam on Milo, by the way. the taking it straight part. So I don't know.
I wasn't going to say anything because I didn't know if you intended it or, yeah. Okay. Excellent.
I intended it, but it was not executed well at all. That's what she said. And the, so I guess I'm going to go with number one, but this is totally a shot in the dark.
All right. Justin, woke or joke?
I'll go second again. All right. This is tough. I actually think the second one is the joke. I really do. Like, cause I don't think anyone would champion the white trash ever. Like, I just don't. I think white trash is just like that. That's just who we don't champion in this society. So it has to be the joke.
All right. James, woke or joke?
I'm tempted to go with the white trash one because I'm tempted to think that it's some kind of like complainy joke from someone from Breitbart. But I think that sounds actually more like an actual headline from Breitbart. So that's woke, I guess, because it's a real headline. It's a broader interpretation of woke. The third one's definitely woke. What's the third one again?
Student group apologizes for playing, quote, problematic Lou Reed song.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, problematic something. Yeah, woke. I mean, come on. The police one, that sounds like a joke because a lot of schools have police. And most of the schools that have police are, in fact, not privileged because they're afraid of the kids shanking each other because it's a frickin' prison. So the first one's the joke, I think.
Wait, I have a question. Can we ask what the Lou Reed song is, or is that giving it away?
I'm not allowed to give you any additional information other than the headline.
Okay.
That's it.
Yeah, because I feel like the song, if we knew what the song was, we would know it if it was a joke or not.
That's right. All right, gentlemen, the joke for this round was headline number one, the epitome of privilege, this school has its own police officers. So yes. The Yale Dean story was from the New York Post, which is kind of like Breitbart. And the student group apologizing was from Heat Street. So the first headline was from clickhole.com, which is the Onion's alternative news site.
The worst website of all time.
That's right.
Click-hole. So what was the song?
I can open it now and tell you. I don't have it off the top of my head. But the song was Lou Reed's 1972 Walk on the Wild Side.
Okay.
It has hurtful and transphobic lyrics, the student said.
Of course it does. Yeah. Aren't all songs transphobic because they're always singing about a man and a woman being together? Like,
lots of rambling. Yeah. So, by the way, Don is the winner this week. Congratulations, Don, with a clean sweep of Woker Joke.
This is going on my bio.
That's right. Breaking Justin's stranglehold on the game. So congratulations.
Yeah, I did
there.
Poorly this week.
I'll just read this for fun of it, because I always have a tiebreaker just for the fun of it. And I love this.
Wait, so the score was Dawn 3, James 2, me 1, correct?
Indeed.
All right.
Swept. The tiebreaker headline this week was Michigan students, quote, intimidated, quote, by masculine wood paneling. Yes, and that is woke, by the way. That is an actual story. They complain.
No! No!
That they complain that the wood paneling in the academic buildings was too masculine.
No, that sounds like a joke that, like, a Ron Swanson fan would write.
That sounds like a joke an Ohio State fan would write.
That's woke!
That is woke.
Oh, my
Sorry,
God!
That hurts my heart, because that's associated with Tom Brady in some way, because he's a masculine male Michigan student.
So thanks, gentlemen, for playing Woke dog. Or Joke, and until next time, stay woke. Or joke. Who cares? It's the same thing.
All right. What did we learn this trip? Don, you can go first, since you're our special guest.
I've learned that I know way too much about the psyche of the social justice warrior, such as to dominate the greatest game show on earth.
That's right.
Daniel?
I learned that basically because I have a Y chromosome, I'm a ticking time bomb for mass murder. I didn't know that before today's show, but watch out! Watch out, society! Any second, that Y chromosome could just go off.
James?
I didn't want to highlight something I learned, but rather a question I'm going to start asking, which is the way we're raising our kids radically changing? And if so, what's the nature of that change and what's causing it? That just seems to be something lurking in the periphery of my, you know, emotional noticings, and I want to learn more about that, if it even is a thing.
Justin, so Justin, what did you learn?
I learned that I get to start making a sex tape a priority.
If you want to be a serious presidential candidate in your lifetime. That's right. So if you learned something this trip, why don't you tell us at themidside.com/podcast, where you can leave a comment on an episode. You can also tweet at The Midside or go to facebook.com/themidside. There's also Instagram. Where aren't we, Rachel? Oh, Snapchat. We have a new Snapchat story. Justin and I have no idea what the fuck this is, so if you could please inform the audience.
Oh, you have no idea what it is? I thought you were trying to say you and James don't have an idea what it is. Yeah, so Snapchat made a new feature where you can make, like, stories that are just for groups of people, and you can make groups of contributors. So for this episode, I made a story that only Daniel, James, and I can contribute to. So if you're a listener of the show, and you have Snapchat, get on Snapchat. I'll add you as a viewer of the story. And as long as we keep adding content, and I'll make a priority to add at least one thing a day, you will get to see Welcome to the Midside exclusive content on Snapchat.
That's right.
Although Snapchat may be going down the shitter, because if you follow Milo on Snapchat, he snapped something earlier today where one of his snaps, where he called Islam a religion of peace facetiously, was taken down, and he was given a message that said if he continues to do it, he could be banned. So that means now social justice warriors are following people on Snapchat, who, by the way, you can only see their stories if you follow them, following them on Snapchat to then report them. So, and if Snapchat starts giving into that, the one thing they had was, like, you can fucking... I mean, there was a porn star who was snapping her giving head to her boyfriend. Like, you can put anything on Snapchat. So if Snapchat starts giving into that, they're dead.
Yeah. Criticizing Islam against community standards. Dick pics, totally fine. Totally fine. What if you wrote the criticism on your dick?
Challenge accepted.
Get a fine point pen. So yeah, there's all that stuff. You can, of course, subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. Leave us a 5-star review. That helps tremendously raise us in the ranks there. And then, of course, patreon.com/themidside. All hail Patreon, where you can choose to give us money, dinero, dollars, every time we create content. So not just for the fuck of it, not monthly or weekly or whatever, but when content arrives in your inbox, that's when you can support us with actual money. That helps us keep the lights on. It helps us buy equipment. It helps us do all sorts of things. But more important than money, yes, there are some things, very few, is tell a friend. Tell a friend. Go to Twitter. Go to Facebook. Go to the top of a mountain and scream The Midside out to the world. Go tell it on the mountain is what I just told you to do. So that helps us grow. We get all of our fans via word of mouth, basically. And of course, thanks to the Liberty.me folks for syndicating us with the Libertarians. Sorry we pissed you off this episode if you're still here. But Don, why don't you tell folks where they can learn more about you and the work that you do?
I mean, the best place is either Twitter or donswriting.com. No apostrophe, heaven forbid.
Absolutely. So thanks so much, Don. We really appreciate you coming on the show. It was awesome, and we're happy to have you back.
Well, it was a good way to revisit our infamous lunches of yonder.
That's right.
Which is nobody else will get, but if they're listening to the last 2 minutes of the show anyway, that's ridiculous.
Go home. You're drunk.
This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin Emelsnesky reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a dawn!